Good evening, everyone, and welcome to a Fireside Chat with Zany Mystic. I'm your host, Lance White. Tonight's guest is artist and author Jerry Wenstrom. After producing a large body of work, at age 29, he set out to discover the rock-bottom truth of his life. After destroying all of his art and giving away everything he owned, Jerry began a life of unconditional trust, allowing life to provide all that was needed. He lived this way for 15 years. In 1998, he moved to Washington State, where he eventually married Marilyn Strong and produced a large new body of art. Marilyn and Jerry's charming Whidbey Island home is now filled with his unique interactive sculptures and paintings. Jerry's story is also told in his new book, which is called The Inspired Heart, An Artist's Journey of Transformation. So let's find out more about this unique path by welcoming him to the show. Hi, Jerry. How are you?
Hi, Lance. Thank you for having me.
Your book provides some really fascinating stories. It's really quite spellbinding and well-written. It's kind of a work of art in its own, isn't it?
Well, I'm not a writer, and I felt like going about it in an artistic way was the only way I knew how to go about it.
So yeah.
It's probably more that than well-written. I'm not sure.
Well, I think what I like most about it is that there's a mystical depth to it, and there's a kind of a blatant honesty about your relationships with all these different people who have influenced you and vice versa, and it's quite a profound, it's kind of like it gets beyond the ordinary, everyday, surfacey meaning of life, and you just penetrate to the deepest levels and, turn over stones that include, drug addictions and alcoholism and just people that live in the street and scary situations. I'm finding it to be a fascinating book to read.
Well, thank you.
Let's go back to so that our listeners understand what happened. And I know you've told this probably before, but where and how did your journey begin? What prompted you when you were in your 20s to destroy all of your artwork? And what were your inner motivations, and how did that come about?
Well, I think, as any creative person would know, there's a certain kind of template written into the creative process that, and I think in the safety of the studio, I explored that that kind of path in a certain sense.
Uh-huh.
And I was extremely driven as a young artist. And I think having really gotten down in the safety, once again, in that sort of closed environment, the kind of that template written in, I feel like the place where I finally felt like I can do this.
Uh-huh.
It's like the place where it began to feel too small. You know, art in the way I was doing it began
yeah.
to feel too small.
Yeah.
And so, that I think in the nature of that template is the sort of complete cycle, in that when you arrive at inspiration, you get there by way of often making a kind of sacrifice. You take a risk, and you may lose what you've done or kind of even lose the status quo of that which you have done well in the past. And in taking that risk is the place inspiration and something new comes through. So having that down, in a certain sense, I felt like the gods upped the ante the moment I felt like I could do this.
Uh-huh.
And I felt like I needed to do it with my whole life at some level.
Wow.
So taking that leap, destroying the work, giving everything I owned away, and trusting life just as it was without interference, I felt like was exactly that kind of risk. And it may have been destructive, it may have been insane, I didn't know. But I intuited, after fasting for a month, it became very clear I could keep doing what I was doing, but it felt like a fear-based choice.
Uh-huh.
Or I could take this risk that I intuited would give me everything I could not achieve on my own. And it, in fact, proved to be the most important thing I've ever done with my life.
Yeah, wow. And then you pretty much remained without resources for about 15 years, is that right?
Yes, I hardly touched money. There was even a whole year I hardly spoke. I simply did what the moment called for. I fasted when I didn't have food. I ate when it came. It was pretty simple, and I simply trusted each moment, each person that walked through the door, I treated as the God of that moment, and I responded accordingly.
That's amazing. Well, that really is kind of the mystical journey, isn't it? You know, even monks can't come that close to that sometimes.
Well,
did you have any thoughts? Of course, the mind has its own thoughts. It's the chatterbox or the monkey mind within us. Did it produce all kinds of regrets the moment you destroyed all your paintings, saying, oh, why did I do that? Or were you pretty clear about it?
Well, I was so elated by the process that
at
first, I mean, of course, over the years when things got really difficult, I wondered what my life was about at times. I think doubt is just part of who we are as human beings.
Uh-huh.
But the initial act, I was so elated and so, you know, felt so completely liberated. But, you know, I had no idea what it meant.
Yeah.
I just knew that that I was so jazzed by just having done that and felt so completely free.
Yeah.
That, you know, sort of carried me for a long time. The other thing the other part of that kind of, you know, in a way where I felt like it was the right thing and it, you know, the kind of magic that carried life, was there was a film being made about my life at the time.
Oh, yes. Yes, talk about that. That was a fascinating story.
Well, and so the filmmakers were working 2 years on this. You know, they were getting the funding, and I was simply there. And it started out to be a film about my art. And so before the film was done, they were nearly complete. And that's when I just had this epiphany, and I destroyed the work, let it all go. And so the filmmakers showed up one day, and they were, you know, needless to say, a little upset. You know, they had invested all this time and money, and here the work was all destroyed. But I felt so inspired by what had happened that I was able to just simply talk to them and inspire them, and that's when they decided to make the film more about my experience, and they did an interview with me. And on that note, you know, there was a new film made 7 years ago, which is called In the Hands of Alchemy, and that film incorporated that old film. So, by the same filmmakers, interestingly enough.
Wow.
You know, the filmmaker looked me up after all these years. That was like 25.
So they basically retailed or retooled the film to incorporate the fact that it was no longer about your artwork because you had destroyed it, and they made it more about you and your life and your journey.
Well, they put that piece in the end. It still very much shows the art destroyed. But I think, I mean, it's almost like the same thing that has empowered my life was that trust and that leap into the void. I think the film became a whole other thing when they did incorporate that.
Uh-huh.
And I couldn't imagine the film without it. I mean, it added such a different mood, different kind of energy to the whole thing. And so, you know, it still has a lot of the art, and except it has this element of that, you know, that leap in a sense.
Yeah.
Actually, if anyone is interested, you can see the film on YouTube, In the Hands of Alchemy, or just put my name in, or there are links to from our website.
Oh, how wonderful!
Yeah.
Okay, so that's on YouTube, and it's called In the Hands of Alchemy.
And there's a link from our website as well.
Oh, good. And your website is, give us that information now, will you?
It's handsofalchemy.com, A-L-C-H-E-M-Y.
And I want to mention that there's a fascinating video where you display and talk about your interactive boxes, which I just found fascinating.
Uh-huh.
They are absolutely, I've always been fascinated with interactive pieces, and yours, you put keys in and you open a thing and then something else does something else. And talk about a little bit about some of the things that they do and how you created those. They're really quite something.
Yes, well, they're very coffin-like. I mean, I'll sort of got as a later understanding, which was not necessarily a plan, but I sort of saw it in retrospect, is that they're very coffin-like, and if you can approach them, they actually do whimsical things, and they dispense gifts, and they just do their secret compartments.
Yeah.
And so what I see is that my journey has been so much about walking into that thing, whatever it is in front of me that looks like death,
yeah,
walking into it, trusting it, starting with the initial leap of letting go of my identity as an artist, because that was the most metaphoric death I could possibly imagine. I identified so much with my art. And so this work, what I see is a kind of final expression of that. They're death-like, they're coffin-like, they're beings inside.
Uh-huh.
And yet they if you can approach them, you find life.
Yeah.
And what there's a funny story. I had this friend visit from St. Louis, and when he walked into my studio, he got really quiet, and he said, if someone wasn't in a very good space, they would be kind of afraid of all of this art.
Yeah.
And I think, that's sort of the initial hit, is that they are a little spooky. But
they are, yeah, a little macabre.
I think that's the nature of those things in our lives, that if we can face those boogeymen, they're full of gifts and joy and life.
Yes, yes, it's a very profound lesson. And in your writing of these various stories, in many of them, you do face your fears, and it's kind of a metaphor for the artwork that you create as well, that this is a reflection of life, and the art is life.
Well, yes, that is certainly true. Yes, I mean, the stories, what I feel about the book is that they are stories of places where I came up over and over again against limitation. And again, that kind of metaphoric death,
yeah,
where I felt all was lost. There's nothing I can do to save myself at this moment,
yep,
in all these different circumstances. And in trusting that was part of the fear, walking into the fears as well.
Yeah.
And by simply staying present with each of those challenges, there was some breakthrough that took me to a new place. And, sometimes it literally saved my life, as some of the stories will demonstrate. And I think, that's what I needed to do, live fearlessly.
Yeah.
And I don't think I was capable of saving myself in all those situations. I think it had more to do with trusting life exactly where it was. That was so much a part of what I was learning.
Yeah.
And the book is a series of those inspirational moments where something broke through.
Yeah, absolutely. What are some of the profound lessons which evolved out of your renunciation of the material world?
Well, I don't think I ever set out to renounce the material world. I just always followed my allurements and my inspiration.
Uh-huh.
And it left me 12 years celibacy, trusting that, I was, without simply not selling out to a lesser moment than what I felt each particular moment called for.
Uh-huh.
And, I fasted a lot. It was never a plan to do that. I never renounced the world for its own sake.
Uh-huh.
I think I was simply excited by what I sensed life could be. I mean, I had, in a certain way, had gotten inspiration down in the, as I said earlier, in the laboratory, in the safety of the studio.
Yeah.
But I needed to do it with my whole life. And I knew if it could happen in art, it could happen in life.
Yeah.
And that's what I gave myself to. And it took a very sort of monastic twist, for sure, years of celibacy and fasting and everything else. But it also was incredibly liberating. And what I learned was the unlimited possibilities that we often overlook in the face of our fears. I think that's all I wanted to learn, was real freedom, how to find life in everything that looks like death.
Yes. I was particularly fascinated by two people, I guess you could call them mentors in a sense, in Chapter 2, Lewis and Gilbert, which was a gay couple that you knew for quite a few years. It reminded me of my own childhood because my parents had quite a few gay friends, and many of them were artists. And I was wondering if you could share some of those experiences about, your relationship with them.
Well, I grew up pretty much in a poor, mostly black neighborhood, where we were the minority, being white. And Gilbert and Lewis were these, Lewis was a concert pianist and Gilbert was an artist. And in a certain sense, they took me under their wing. And what I saw, and as I wrote in my book, it was a struggle because I wasn't gay. And, I think that was always a challenge for them, especially Gilbert. Some of the funnier stories in the chapter you're talking about describe some of it. But I think what I got out of that relationship, out of that friendship, and was a kind of enculturation. They were so cultured, and I went to the opera for the first time, and they would take me to the museums, and it was really quite a good relationship in that way.
Right.
But I felt, and where the relationship in a certain sense ended, is that I saw and I think it's a generation thing. I mean, it's not personally their problem, you might say. I think that generation was a generation where we were allowed to be two halves to a complete whole.
Yeah.
When I left, Gilbert was going blind, the artist Gilbert was going blind. And I was saying to him, Gilbert, if that's what you're given, you have to trust that, and that's God too. And he would kind of say, well, that's easy for you to say. You're young and you're just starting out and you're getting this attention as an artist. And so it was around that time that I realized that that was all part of what was stirring when I ultimately destroyed my work. I had to become the thing I was talking about to Gilbert and to everyone else. I sensed something larger than what it is I was so completely committed to. And art for me was a kind of false god. There's no question about it.
Yeah.
And so I think when I destroyed my art, first Gilbert was, he cried literally because he was struggling so much having to give up his own art.
Yeah.
And he said, congratulations. But then he projected all of his fear on me and what I had done. And that's where I couldn't do it. I couldn't maintain the relationship anymore because, I had stepped into this new territory that I had been talking about.
Yeah.
And he was just too terrified of it at that point, understandably.
The fear of the unknown.
Yeah. But I also saw that's where, because Lewis was such an introvert, Gilbert such an extrovert, I saw that they, like I said, they completed a circle, but alone, there was territory they could not inhabit that the other inhabited well. And I think that was the limit I came up to with them, where I realized I have to find completeness in myself, and I can't do life like that. And I think that's, all of that is where it just simply had to end.
Well, they were certainly eccentric people. I love your description of their living place, with all the sliding panels, and then there was another room after that. It was very colorful.
They were very colorful, for sure.
Yeah.
And wonderful people.
How important is it in the creative process or in any process to have blocks of time with nothing to do but to just be?
Well, it's imperative, you know. But I think the difference for me now, I used to kind of panic when art was my god.
Yeah.
You know, when your god disappears for a while, what do you do but panic?
Yeah, yeah.
I think now, having let it go and returned in the most gentle way, where I feel having let it go, I'm also so much more detached. It doesn't matter if I do it or not. What I tend now is each moment, and everything is as important as everything else, which puts art in with that, but it's no more or less. So whatever is happening, whether I have a visitor or I'm doing a phone interview, whatever is going on is exactly what I trust is to be done.
Yeah.
And so art now, when there's space, or I don't have the energy, or I don't feel inspired, I simply trust that. You know, net life now is about being with what is, exactly where it is.
Yes.
I can give you an interesting story, because it was even a revelation to me about that kind of space and being with what is. I was going with my wife to visit her parents in Spokane, Washington. And I was so exhausted. I had been with so many people, and we were on the road, and I was so completely exhausted that I didn't, you know, and Marilyn's mother really loves me, and I love her, and she loves to do things, and, you know, she wants me to do everything with her, and she talks 100 miles an hour because she's excited that we're there, which is all very beautiful.
Yeah.
But I knew I didn't have the energy to do that, and I didn't know what to do about it. I was almost, like, shaking in my boots having to do this because I had nothing left. I had no more energy. And when we arrived, but I had to go. I just thought, well, I'm just going to go and see what happens. And so when we arrived, you know, like usual, her mother was very talkative and excited. And Marilyn and her dad had gone out, so it was just her mom and I. And finally, in the midst of all this enthusiasm, I said, let's go for a bicycle ride. And so I just, you know, had stopped the conversation, and she said, oh, okay. So we went for a bicycle ride, at first she was talking, and then I didn't answer. I was just pedaling slowly, just doing what I could do, being with what is, which at that moment was nothing. I could do nothing. I could be nothing. Trusting that, you know, it's a lot like what happens with art. You trust even the emptiness.
Yes.
And in doing it, it was almost like we went into a kind of bubble together, which was very trance-like almost. And I almost felt like we were pedaling in slow motion. And Spokane's a wonderful place to ride bicycles. It has these huge, long trails and parks. It's gorgeous landscape. And we just spent several hours just slowly wandering silently, which finally is what it turned into. What's so interesting is she still talks about how special that was. And so the point is, even the emptiness has meaning if you can trust it, you know, because our tendency is, I have to talk. I have to be on here and be my usual enthusiastic self. But I couldn't do it. So in trusting the emptiness, that in itself was the inspiration.
Yes, yeah. Beautiful.
And I learned as much from that as she did. I mean, it's not like I was here to teach her a lesson. I was trying to survive.
Right, right. That's a beautiful story. You've seen and lived the shadow or dark side of life pretty fully. What do you recall as being one of your darker nights of the soul?
Well, I think they're pretty much the darkest ones are pretty much in the book. You know, I mean, I think death is a cyclical event where, you know, when we're flying high, life is wonderful, everything's easy, we have energy, everything seems to feel exactly where it needs to be. And then in the cycle, we have to all let go of that, let go of our control. It's almost like phases of the moon. The place where the moon disappears completely is part of what we have to learn to inhabit. So there are many moments like that in life, but I feel at this celebratory end of things, I've so incorporated the darkness into the totality of the cycle that it's pretty natural for me now. So So it's hard to say what was the darkest. I would have to say one of the darkest was certainly when I got a hit. You know, after getting a hit that I needed to let go of everything, let go of my identity as an artist, let go of my possessions, and just let it all go. The initial hit was pure. It was almost like what happened with Gilbert. The first hit was knowing in a very deep way the perfection of that possibility and the rightness of giving myself to it. And then the moment of sheer terror, because everything that I was as a human being was tied up in my art. Who would I be if I wasn't an artist in that kind of a way? So I would have to say that first moment was probably the darkest. But then, like learning to dance, I mean, you say, why would you want to put your foot here? And then you have to put your foot here in the dance. Why would you want to do that? It makes no sense. Later in life, the music comes on. It's so automatic that it becomes a dance. And I think it's very similar, you know. The darkness was just before the dawn, quite literally, you know. And once I gave myself to it, I was so elated. I mean, and then, you know, what we talked about earlier, then the film, when the film was being made, the night the film was shown at this very artsy establishment, and, you know, New York was flying high on that kind of golden calf of art in the 70s.
Yeah.
And this was a very savvy, artsy crowd who showed up, and they showed my film, and that moment when the audience was all there, and I wasn't even going to go to the film showing. You know, if you read the book, the story is all there.
Yeah.
But I ended up at the film showing. I ended up on stage. There were a couple hundred people in the audience. And what I felt happen at that event, and this was like the first time the film was shown after I had destroyed my art, that evening was the most powerful night of my life. I felt all of the time, energy, love, commitment, everything I had that I put into that work that was gone now was transmuted, and I felt like I became the thing that I was trying to be as an artist.
Wow.
And, you know, and Einstein says matter never dies, it just changes form.
Right.
I feel like that is such a deep truth that, you know, and that's the meaning of sacrifice. And I don't think we have to go around sacrificing things, but I think if we're called to let go of something that no longer serves our life, in the letting go, what comes is a new form and more beautiful and inspired form of the same thing.
Yeah.
And incidentally, I became more known as an artist for destroying my work than I ever did for creating it. So there's part of the paradox.
Yes, very paradoxical. So in destroying all your artwork, you became the ultimate artist. You know,
you're
beyond artists, and you know, it's quite a statement. So and you got quite an ovation, didn't you, at that showing? They enjoyed it quite a bit.
Yes, it was a very powerful night.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
I have never known another like it, I have to say.
Do you follow any particular spiritual path, or does it just simply show up as your life?
Well, I certainly have read about most of the major spiritual paths and religions. And what I felt like when I destroyed my art was my religion.
Yeah.
You know, however misguided. And when I gave that up, I could not take on another form. I mean, I already had my religion, and it failed me, you know, in a certain way. In other words, I couldn't get there from here by way of my will, intelligence, and good intentions.
Right.
And I couldn't imagine any form giving me what I had received by way of simply stepping off into the void. And so, you know, I see the oneness in religion. When you go deeply into any one, what you see, it's the same form. It's the same thing with a different form.
Right.
There's that essential, incredible beauty. And that's not to say I don't honor people who have found a particular path. I do honor it. I just know for me, I couldn't find a form that I could give myself to after jumping into the formlessness.
Well, yes, especially since most of religion embodies some kind of restrictive quality or limitation at its worst.
Well, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, look at the limitations I gave myself. I fasted so much one year, I thought I was going to dry up and blow away. I mean, limitation, that's not necessarily wrong.
Yeah. Now, when your artwork is your present artwork, when did you start working on getting back in touch with building these, you know, what was your first piece of work that you did? Were those the interactive boxes, or?
Well, at the very first, you know, because I had given up art, I had nothing more to do with the film. The filmmaker was quite famous, Mark Sedan, and now the new film is with him and Phil Lucas, who's Native American film director.
Mm.
And so, you know, when I gave all of that up, I gave the film up, I thought I would never go back to art. And one day, I was walking, you know, when I had nothing, I had given it all. I was walking down the street, and I found this envelope on the ground, and I picked it up. It was a blank envelope, but it had a stamp on it, and it had a piece of paper inside, so I decided to write a letter. And the stamp was the head of someone famous.
Oh.
And so off of the head, I drew a body, and then I drew an entire scene, and I just played with that envelope for a good part of the day, creating this very elaborate envelope. I wrote the letter, sent it out. But the innocent sort of dabbling with that, with art again, in that kind of a way, it felt so completely detached and innocent. And I was good at it. I mean, it's like, you know, it was available, it was there, and I was finally, you know, going back into it, and being in touch with that innocence and that detachment, that's where it all began again, because I felt like, well, I can just do it from that place now.
Yeah.
It's not so important, it's not so driven, it's not so such a false god.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
From there, you know, I was still... That was years ago, and you know, I began doing things wherever I was, and when I moved to Whidbey Island, I have this big 2,000 square foot studio now that's full of these boxes, and that came later. I started doing murals in the space, and so the space is quite full of all of it, which again you can see much of on our website at handsofalchemy.com for anyone who wants to see it.
Oh yes, it's definitely worth visiting. Definitely. How did you come about doing the mechanical aspects of the box? Because they're so interesting. They're like, they're almost, they just kind of draw you in. Some of them, like I said, you put a key in and that opens a door. And some you put you get a ticket. Describe some of the different things that they do that are kind of whimsical and fun.
Well, they all have secret compartments. They all have a main chamber inside with a life-size being. They're carved cedar and mechanical parts, as you say, and there's a life-size being inside, one way or another. So that's the basics of all of them. They're coffin-like from 6 to 8 or 9 feet high. One of them actually has a steam engine. You light a fire in the pubic area, open a little door, you light a fire in there, there's a burner, a boiler, that it gets a steam engine going in the heart, and a little goddess dances, a mask comes out, looks around, and goes back in. And then there's a panel on the side, when you flip the button, it does Tibetan chanting. And, you know, there's a series of these buzzers that go up and down this triangular-shaped box. And because of the way it's shaped, they resonate differently at each station. And so it has the effect of Tibetan chanting.
Yeah.
One of them has a key, the key to heaven that you described. You put in a dime, turn this crank, and a little angel ticket comes out. And you write a prayer on the back and put it in this prayer wheel that spins. And then when it has all secret compartments with deities from different spiritual traditions.
Mm.
And when you turn the key to heaven, after you've, you know, done your little prayer, there are wings on the side of the box that come up and start waving, flapping. The chamber opens up, and there's a mask inside that's split down the middle. The mask opens up, and there's another face behind that, and there are these glass, actually real glass eyes, like artificial eyes, that the mask has looking out at you, and then the eyes roll back in its head, and then up above there's a skeleton that comes up out of this kind of decayed wood and appears and then goes back down and disappears. Oh, and it plays Amazing Grace.
Yes. And that's all on the video, too, that you can that people can watch.
On the YouTube. Oh, it's actually on our website, too.
And it's on the website, yes. I was just fascinated by that. That's just amazing stuff.
Oh, thanks. That's actually a new video. Well, it was recently put up. A friend edited it and put it up, and another friend actually made it, but it's been sitting around, so it's finally up on YouTube.
Now, you're not planning on destroying all your artwork again, are you?
I have no reason to do that, you know? I feel like now, it's almost like I think we need to let the gods know we mean business one good time in our lives.
Yeah.
But I think after that, it's just the intent that matters. And I know now, when I come up against, again, in the cyclical nature of things, that metaphoric place of death, I know between God and I'm willing to let it all go. I'm willing to let my relationship go, which I adore, my beautiful wife, my beautiful place here, all of it. I know when I feel like I can't hold on to all this, a willingness to let it go and meaning it. And that's just between God and us. We can't fake a moment like that.
That's right.
It's the that, in a certain sense, purity of intent, willingness to give myself over and over again to the spirit of the journey more than the stuff of it.
Yes.
It's actually what renews it and gives it all back to me. I feel that's what keeps my world alive, the letting go, not the holding on.
Yeah, I like that a lot. It seems that we're like a lending library, and everything that comes into our lives, including our bodies, is here on loan, you know, for a finite period of time, and it's what we do with it in the process.
Yeah.
And, you know, if we're too attached to it, then it creates problems that keep us kind of mired and stuck in certain ways.
Yeah. Well, you know, the meaning of sacrifice translation is to make sacred. Mm-hmm. And there's something about the willingness to let a thing go. And we often have to do it with the things we love the most. Like for me, it was art. It was such a complete identity.
Yeah.
And in letting it go, it is made sacred and given back to us. You know, we put what we love on the altar in a certain sense with a willingness that we may never have it again.
Yeah.
But if that's what we have to do, we value the moment and the spirit of the moment enough that we're willing to do that for life itself. It's sanctified and given back to us. If we don't do that, we're always, you know, our whole life is about hustling the existence of the thing we're attached to, whether it's our family or our children or our money or whatever else we think we're doing. If we can't put it on the altar and let it be sanctified, our lives are spent in fear trying to keep it from disappearing.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing is, in the end, we usually lose it anyway. And I don't just mean in death. I mean, in some way, the thing we're excessively attached to will disappear.
Yeah, exactly. In some of your stories, it's clear that you face your fears. I think there was one story about some thugs that were demanding that you keep coming back. They kept saying, come back here, and they were trying to get something from you, and you gave them raisins or something. Do you remember that story?
Yes.
I thought that was a particularly interesting one. Do you want to share that one?
Yeah, sure. Well, after I had let go of everything, and I was fasting so much, I would, you know, in a lot of ways, for anyone who's done any fasting, you know that you can have this incredible energy running through you, and you don't necessarily sleep very much. at that point in my life, my time was so completely my own because I had nothing and I wasn't doing, you know, what it, I had given my loft, the studio part of my loft to somebody who needed a studio. He was paying the cheap rent at that time. So I had the small living quarters. I had a place to be. But I used to go out for walks at any hour, day or night, because that's what I did what I wanted in the moment. And so going for a walk late one night, I walked by the YMCA, and there was a group of young men on the stoop, sitting on the stoop, and there were some women with them. And when I walked, it was late, kind of a little nervous walking by. When I did, one of the guys came up to me and he says, "Got a cigarette?" And I said, "No, sorry, I don't smoke," and I kept walking. And so I'm pretty far down the street, and he says, "Hey, come here." So it was one of those moments where you either keep walking, give in to your fear, or this moment too is God. That was my personal mantra, this too is God. That's what I would say when I was in the midst of my terror or whatever, my hunger, my emptiness, this too is God. I decided to go back. So I turned around, I walked back, and he said, he had a cigarette between his teeth, and he said, "Got a match?" And I said, "No, sorry, I don't smoke." And I continued walking. So even further down the road, he says, "Hey, come back here." So again, there's that moment I could keep going, turn around. I turned around. And when I went back, he said, "What do you have?" And at that point, the gang surrounded me. And the women continued sitting on the stoop, watching it all. And so the only thing I had, I used to carry these little miniature boxes of Superman brand raisins for the children in the neighborhood. You know, they knew me, and when they see me, they'd come running, and I'd give them raisins. And so it's all I had was a pocket full of those little boxes of raisins. So I gave one to each one, and set them down on the stoop and continued walking. And when I was down the road, I heard the boxes of raisins hit the road. They were throwing them. And they said, "Get back here." And so I thought, okay, here it is again. And I turned around, I went back. And at that point, the leader who was sort of, instigating this whole thing was like right in my face and said, "What do you think you're doing?" He was very aggressive. "What are you doing giving me raisins?" And it was an interesting moment because, like I said earlier, I grew up in a poor, mostly black neighborhood. And I grew up more black than white, which is kind of interesting. And so I had such a deep sense of black culture in young black men because I was practically one myself in my culture.
Yeah.
I mean, so much so that I had to learn to speak like a white person. When I was in school, I was actually embarrassed that, you know, I wasn't speaking. I sounded like I was not where I was.
Yeah.
So anyway, so having that history, when he said, "What are you doing giving me these raisins?" I was able to access a deep love for these young black men.
Yeah.
And in feeling that love, I said, and it was more a total experience than actually just saying it, I said I was just trying to be kind. And in saying it, it was such a surrender. And I was feeling the love and understanding the anger and the confusion of these kids and feeling it so completely. The women jumped up and they surrounded me and they said, "You leave him be," to the leader. They said, "You be on your way now. They don't mean you no harm." And so I quickly walked away. And when I walked away, I just glanced at the leader, and I saw this look of pain go over his face because the women he was trying to impress had defected, and they had come over to my side. And again, it was one of those moments where if there's a God in this moment, that was it.
Yeah.
And what I find is that when we can face our fears, it's always there.
Yeah. Well, that's an amazing experience. You know, and even when we don't face it, we get another opportunity down the road to, you know, that opportunity always rears its head again.
Yeah. Well, what I find, what I believe is true, what I know is true, is that our fears are each our own, and we sort of call them up as we need them.
Yeah.
And so we all have different experiences. And the fears we don't transcend. We don't find inspiration in. chase us through our lives. They always have a new face. You know, there was a part of me that was afraid of gangs. There was a part of me that was afraid of the street life that where I lived. It was a pretty shady neighborhood anyway. You know, all of that was a part of my psyche that was, I didn't even know was running, which was fear-based.
Yeah.
And so that's what came up. I know if I did not deal with it then and find the inspiration even in that, I would still be running from that boogeyman one way or another.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And then the more frightened you are, the more you attract the experiences that create fright.
Yes, and then you head yourself in so completely trying to avoid things like that you might as well be in jail.
Exactly. You knew a lot of interesting and sometimes mystical and crazy people. I guess you could say crazy, that people would call crazy. Are there any that you'd like to share about that stand out in your mind?
Well, those are kind of long stories. You know, again, that's, as you know, it's written more in the book.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know that there is. There was, I'm sure many of your listeners probably know Hilda Charlatan, interesting name, but Hilda was most certainly a zany mystic. You know, she was a really interesting, powerful woman. She used to do these evenings once a week at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York City. And I was there, I was brought there once, and it was such a completely powerful experience. It was really one of the things that initiated me letting go of my identity because of a story she told, and just because of who she is. I mean, she is this amazing. You know, of course, she's dead now. She was probably 80 at the time, or around 80. But that she was certainly one, you know, in the most outrageous, wild being. And, you know, if ever anyone I ever met who was a saint, I think it was her.
Wow. Well, that story, you know, which your book starts with that story, it's not a long story, but I'll tell you, it's a very powerful story. Mm-hmm. And you definitely get the feeling that this is a very special shamanic woman. I mean, she's definitely a mystic and, you know, a very deep spiritual person that's not necessarily there to make people feel better.
Yeah, she's, and I think her work is healing. I mean, you know, whether you like the way she goes about it or
right.
not, you come away awakened for sure.
Yeah, right. There are a lot of people that teach that way. They are a bit abrasive.
Yeah. Well, it was so interesting. It was my one and only encounter with her, and it was such an important one. You know, again, there was a part of me that wanted a guru. I wanted a tradition. When my life felt so strange and empty, I wished I could have been part of a monastic life where I could at least eat three meals a day or even one meal. But, you know, again, that was sort of the nature of my journey, was that I would get these real inspiring things that happened, but then I'd have to let them go. I couldn't latch on to anything as much as I even wanted to.
Yeah. What do what have you noticed over the years in terms of where society is going as a whole? How do you feel about the direction that our world is traveling in now?
Well, I mean, I think we're all in the best seat in the house. In many ways, what I see in retrospect is that, you know, my journey, and it's not just mine, I think any of us who have said yes to life has had to go through the metaphoric death experience that I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I think it's so up in our world right now. And like I say, in the cyclical nature of things, I think we are at the death place. And so, of course, the artists, the poets, the most sensitive among us are the first to go. Many people we're working with are people, one way or another, are going through it. Because I think we are going through it in order to facilitate it in a larger, more collective way in our world.
Yeah.
So where I think our world is going, I think we are walking into everything that looks like death. And all I can say is I know from my own experience that if we can give ourselves to it, we will find renewal and life. And that's the gift in this time. And yet, you're going to have things like this war, which is a desperate attempt not to experience loss. Basically, we need oil, so let's kill people to get it. And I think that's one response to death and limitation, is to do whatever it takes to get it, however ugly the behavior is.
Yeah.
Or we could give ourselves to it, because we are going through a change. There's no avoiding it. All we can do by trying to avoid this cycle of death is to create a lot of useless suffering for ourselves and other people.
Yeah.
And that's a big part of what's going on. But also what's going on is that so many of us are making the transition, and I think finding life in less, finding life in limitation. And that's what's so exciting about this time. It's both a nightmare if you're attached to the way things were,
right,
and there are incredible possibilities right here and right now. But it is the death part of the cycle. And I think it's going to look and feel just like indistinguishable from loss and death, but it's life.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned Kali earlier. Some say it's the Kali Yuga.
Yes, there are many different traditions that say this is the time.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, well, you could rattle them off, and it would take a while to mention them all, but... You know,
well,
especially
really
the Mayan prophecies that end in 2012 are quite, surfacing quite a bit right now, too. In fact, speaking about death, that seems to be something that binds your artwork together. You play with death almost with your artwork. And also, there's a little bit of shock value in the death part when some of those little boxes open up and there's a skull to the jaw that opens up. I like that, actually. Uh-huh. I know that's intentional, obviously, because that's how you made it. But there's still that playful quality to it.
Well, you know, I think when we can face our boogeymen, I think we get better and better at it. So again, at first it's often the thing we feel we need to do, what goes through some difficulty. It feels and looks everything like our worst nightmare.
Yeah.
But the thing is, once we can give ourselves to it, we actually, death becomes our trump card. It becomes the thing that saves us. Most of us are so busy trying to save ourselves in one way or another, with enough money or the most perfectly beautiful husband or wife, or
yep,
if we only had the perfect car and the
yep,
2.1 kids and everything we're supposed to have, life would be great.
Yep.
And so, but the opposite, and what's more true, is that if we can really face the emptiness, really face the death, that's where everything comes in.
Yeah. I agree. I like that quite a bit. We're going to be running out of time, but do you want to talk about that big tower that you built on your, at all, that you built on your place?
Yeah, I have a 40-some foot high tower, which is only basically 8 foot square is the room of it. It's a little meditation tower. And my wife wanted a meditation space, and so for years I would gather material. Finally, not knowing how to build, I built this tower, and I worked all summer so intensely. I was so joyful. It was such a joyful process. I had no idea what I was doing. Whenever I was about to make some, mistake that there would be no turning back if I had made it, someone would show up and say, did you think about this? Or something would come, or everything fell so beautifully into place. When it was done, I thought I would love to have it blessed, because, it's like a tall church steeple.
Yes.
And so I thought, well, Marilyn, my wife, was doing Tibetan practice, and I thought, wouldn't it be cool to have the Dalai Lama bless it? But I thought, that's not going to happen. I doubted the possibility, which probably was wise. But I, one day walking, our land is right up against the Whidbey Institute here, on Whidbey Island. And there were some Tibetan monks staying there, and I was walking through the woods one day, and this soccer ball flies into the stinging nettles, and this bear armed monk was about to go into the nettles to get it, and I said, no, wait, don't go in there. And I had long sleeves, so I got it for him. I asked the monks if they would come and bless my tower. So nine, and they were lamas. You know,
wow.
There, the monks traveled around the U.S. creating sand mandalas and talking about the plight of the Tibetans in relation
wow.
to the Chinese. So nine lamas piled on this little eight-foot tower and did this incredible blessing, which, incidentally, is in the film, too. The filmmakers were here the day they showed up.
Wow.
And so that, then when the tower was blessed and finished, and I finally finished the staircase, which goes up about 10 feet to
uh-huh.
enter the tower, you have to start 10 feet up. I was lying on the lawn when it was all done, and I felt like, oh, it's finished. And at the moment I said that to myself, the phone rang, and it was Laura Chester calling from the East Coast, Massachusetts, and she said, I heard you built a tower. I'm doing a book called Holy Personal on personal, private, space, sacred spaces, and I'd love to come out and film your tower, or photograph your tower,
wow.
and interview you. So she did. She came. The tower is in the book, Holy Personal. And it was just all part of the magic, you know.
Wow.
That part of everything fell into place so beautifully. And I attribute it to the. I think when we give to God, God gives to us.
Yeah.
And I think we can't manipulate that possibility, but the intent was right, and everything, you know, the wind was in my sails.
Yeah. Well, we have 30 seconds left. Mention your site again, where people can get your book, The Inspired Heart, and see your film and your artwork.
Yes, handsofalchemy.com. And or if you put my name, Jerry Wenstrom, Wennstrom, in the YouTube search, you'll see lots of videos, interviews, and the art videos. And all
and
the